This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Focuses on fighting for ideas and dollars. The three panelists this evening will cover the origins of women's studies at PSU and a lawsuit for equity for women faculty in the Oregon higher education system. 10 years before gaining official recognition as a program, female students and professors met to plan and implement the inclusion of women's studies courses at Portland State University.
You know, what's interesting, these lawsuits that the women engaged in here at Portland State were not unique to Oregon. In fact, at the time, just a little before the lawsuits here, was the Title IX lawsuits in 1972, which involved women in sports in the universities. At that time, less than 32,000 women played sports in college and fewer than 300,000 girls in high school. After Title IX, the lawsuit that allowed women to participate in sports at equal levels as men and boys, those numbers have risen to more than 170,000 women and more than 3 million girls. And in fact, those lawsuits are still continuing. Some of the lawsuits about gender discrimination, just a few years ago, there was one at Fresno State.
And tonight's panelists actually are going to be Julia Allen, who participated as a grad student in the development of the Women's Studies program at Portland State University. Mona Glazer, a professor emerita in the Sociology Department, who is co-founder of Women's Studies at Portland State University as well. Marjorie Burns, who was a witness for Pank versus the Oregon State Board of Higher Education in 1980. 22 Oregon women faculty members filed Pank et al. Though the case was eventually lost in court, it did spark the Oregon legislature to ultimately pass a law against discrimination in institutions of higher education. You've heard just now from Jenka about how those cases have evolved and what's happening even now. The ripples of this are being felt.
Well, gender discrimination is over.
It's continuing to go on. This is not just history. It's also present, right? Joanne Reynolds, also associate counsel with Don Wilner in the Pank case, which was tried in 84 through 85. So we thank you for joining us on the air. It is a live discussion here at Portland State University tonight, being hosted and moderated by Sandy Polishek.
Sandy is actually a former KBOO volunteer and host. She was in the early days of public affairs at KBOO in the 1980s, and we are about to go to Sandy Polishek on the stage to begin this panel.
Thank you, and welcome, you hearty souls here who made it out on this miserable, rainy, supposedly spring evening, and welcome also to everyone listening on KBOO. On behalf of the History of Social Justice Organizing, Occupy History, and our co-sponsor for this evening, the Center for Women, Politics, and Policy, welcome to part three of the Portland Women's Movement, Fighting for Ideas and Dollars. We're going to have four panelists tonight, but before I introduce them, I just want to say a few little housekeeping things. First of all, this is the last one for us before the summer, and we'll be back in the fall. You can find out about our next program by either signing up. We have a sheet like this out on the table in the hall, and you can sign up to get emails about our next programs. Also on that table is information about KBOO. Also, there are evaluation forms for this evening's presentation. There is because we are here about social justice, there is a petition out there from 350 PDX. It's a petition to the Portland City Council to ask them to divest from any of their fossil fuel investments. You can sign the petition out there. And you at home can go to 350pbx.org to sign it. And I think that's all. So our format tonight, we have four speakers on two subjects. The first two are going to be speaking about women's studies here at Portland State, the founding, early years, the founding of it. And the second two are going to be talking about a lawsuit that women in the Oregon higher education system brought against the state for equity. The first two speakers, we're going to have women's studies first. The first speaker is going to be Nona Glazer. She is a professor emerita in sociology here at PSU. She co-founded the Women's Studies program with two other professors, Nancy Porter and Nancy Hoffman, and many PSU students. Many of her publications address women's unwaged labor and its use by capitalist firms to reduce their wage costs in healthcare delivery and retailing. Other work is on curriculum integration with her naive expectation that gender, class, and ethnicity would quickly become part of all university curricula rather than being lodged mainly in special studies programs. She was also a plaintiff in Pank versus et al. Versus the Oregon State Board of Higher Education, which is coming up next. Julie Allen, and I'm introducing them in the order they are sitting. Farthest left first. Second is Julie M. Allen. She was a graduate student at PSU when women's studies was getting developed, and she was a big participant in that in the early to mid 70s. After she left PSU, she taught women's studies. Well, here she taught Introduction to Women's Studies and developed a course in feminist critical theory as well. She went on to study rhetoric at the University of Texas at Austin, and she was a member of the faculty at Sonoma State University, where she developed more courses focused on rhetoric and social movements. She's recently completed a biography of Anne Rochester and Grace Hutchins, whose partnership and devotion to each other fueled their activism for labor and women's rights. And I'm pleased to have a copy of the book here this evening. It's just out in hardcover. She warns us that it's very expensive, but that a more affordable paperback edition is coming out next year. Our third speaker is Joanne Reynolds. She was associate counsel with Don Wilner in representing the class of women faculty members in the Penck case, which was tried from September 1984 to June 1985. She now specializes in family law, representing clients in divorce, parenting, support, property division, and other family matters. She is of counsel to Yates, Matthew, and Eaton, PC in Portland. Before that, she was an associate and then a partner with Wilner Bennett Firm from 1980 through 2002. Marjorie Burns, sitting closest to me here, was a witness for Penck versus Oregon State Board of Higher Education in the 80s. Though she's published on women's studies and testified about women's issues in both California and Oregon, her main area of expertise is 19th century British literature. She's been on the faculty of Portland State for 37 years. She's now professor emerita. She's also taught at Berkeley, where she got her doctorate, Lewis and Clark, Stanford, University of Oslo, and the University of Trondheim, which is also in Norway, where she was a Fulbright scholar. She has many, many publications. Her most recent to be republished by Ulican Press here at PSU is The Great Missoula Floods. She lives in Trout Lake, which is at the base of Mount Adams. And she was, as a witness in Penck versus the Oregon State Board of Education, she fell in love with, and he fell in love with her, Don Wilner, the chief attorney, who unfortunately has passed on. But here is his picture, and tonight is his birthday. And that's how we picked the date for this event. And Marjorie will say a little more about that when it comes her turn. So they're each going to speak for about 10 minutes, and partly because we're broadcasting it, we will not be taking any Q&A or discussion until all four of them have spoken, because we're going to need you to speak on the mic if you have a question. So we will start now with Nona.
Hello. I'm going to talk about women's studies from the standpoint of organizing, because that's, I think, the theme of this. And I'm going to make one point very quickly, and that is that women's studies, organizing for women's studies, occurred in a particular historical context, at which I think is important, because when we try to organize kinds of things, we're doing it at a particular historical moment. And the moment was just incredible kinds of activities and actions throughout the United States from all different kinds of groups. And in addition to that, with the anti-war group, students were organizing and protesting. Civil rights, the universities were great places of ferment. And then as well as that, there were important books that were published, Betty Friedan, Simone de Beauvoir, that certainly, one of my friends says nobody was reading, but some of us were. And then third, I had my own personal experience, which was someone who came from somewhere between the old left and the new left, if that is a category, and who thought that organizing for women, because now by then was an organization, was just unimportant. The important thing was to organize civil rights. And I had an experience in the summer of 1969 in which I was totally bored at the ASA, American Sociological Society, meeting. And we went across to Glide Memorial Church. I walked into this room of women who were beginning to organize the caucus in sociology. And what I listened to for 45 minutes was four panelists, like Tanae, and very different women, very different kinds of women. And throughout the room would come these laughters of recognition. And for the first time in my life, I realized that it wasn't that I was some kind of an idiot or ill-mannered or stupid or didn't know how to get along with at the university, but that I was being subject to things that were really systemic to the university and systemic to our society. So I came back from that meeting in August, primed. And then in the winter of 1969, Portland State students, who have to be unnamed because I don't know who they were anymore, it was 45 years ago or so, approached me and asked if I would teach a course on women. And I said, sure, why not? It was too late for me for it to actually be officially in the catalog, because the catalog, or, you know, this previous spring. So I was allowed to teach it as an overload. And I'm being ironic. And I taught it as an overload several times. And then because of the nature of the university, the flexibility of Portland State, it was then I began to teach it on a regular basis. I often taught two sections a term. And I taught it until I decided I didn't want to teach it anymore, or maybe we finally hired other women in the department, because I was the only woman for years. And that woman, one of those women, wanted to teach it. The interesting thing to me when I think about this for this presentation is, what did we want and what did we get? And I think what we wanted, it was Nancy Porter, Nancy Hoffman, myself, meeting, I think, with the help of other women in the English department on the faculty, which there were more women there than any place else in the university, and students from throughout the university. What did we want? I don't know that we knew anything in great detail about what we wanted, except we wanted courses about women in the university. That was the main thing that we wanted, because we thought that the viewpoint of women, the experience of women, topics specific to women, child care, housework, domestic labor, all those kinds of things, were never touched upon in the curriculum unless accidentally, maybe in a footnote. So, and the second thing was that the only way we thought about doing that was to have a special studies program. And so we wanted a special studies program. And what this meant, the consequences of that, was that we wanted other things. We wanted more women faculty, and we wanted a place for feminist research. Because if you're at a university, the pressure is that you have to do research. And so that we ended up at least with those kinds of things, a special studies program and so on and so forth, and feminist scholarship, more women. And there was a very positive outcome that I think was really very clear, that one of the things that we got from this was that women students had a place to go. the place to go was both courses in the department that were women and you could fill in whatever that and that follows the and. And it also was a women's studies program that was located in the College of Humanities, I think is what it was then. Bill Hamilton, for reasons I have no idea about, agreed to fund what we really decided was an ad hoc program, because we knew that the State Board would not approve it because it would be a, quote, duplication, and it was against the rules to duplicate. So we said we were going to have an ad hoc program. We called it ad hoc, literally, Program in Women's Studies. And we just kind of went with it, teaching courses, gathering faculty from around the university. And it created a place for women faculty, and it created a place for women students. I think it really became a kind of place in which women could work with some of the problems, women students could work with some of the problems that they encountered. And in the long run, what happened was that we got courses throughout the university. If you look at the Portland State Catalog, or many of the major universities, certainly public institutions throughout the United States, there are women's studies programs, women's studies courses. I think we were maybe the third program, even though we're second or third, I guess, San Diego State, University of Oregon, and then Portland State, even though we were ad hoc for, I don't know, a long time. That was, I think, really important, because it then forced the departments over the long run to think about maybe we need more women. The departments are interested in getting students. So if we're going to teach a course on how to open wine with corkscrews, I exaggerate, but I think that some department would say, oh, that's a great idea. So I think that in some ways, the very flexibility, the openness, and the goals of the university helped us at Portland State. It didn't help us in all kinds of ways, but at least it helped us to get those courses in. I think the other thing that I want to say about women's studies was that it really gave a home for people like myself, and I think other people who were really multidisciplinary in their view of the world. It wasn't that you couldn't do that in sociology, but it was more that in women's studies it became so clear and so apparent that you had to work across the disciplines, that those disciplines had to include biology as well as history and economics and so on and so forth. And it was kind of fun to do that. I liked doing it a lot. The more negative side of what I think of about as women's studies is that I think in some ways what's happened is that women's studies and feminist scholarship has become a kind of institutional way of continuing to marginalize women. I think that in some ways, not, you know, in some ways it's not, in some ways it is, that when I look through the journal that I looked through in sociology, it just, I really kind of freak, because I see that what people are doing, for example, is saying that, well, we need a way of talking about women and class and ethnicity at the same time. And I'm thinking, wait a second. We need a way of talking about human beings in the society of class and race and ethnicity at the same time. And so this is what I mean by the kind of marginalization that can occur. And it's a problem. It really is a problem. I worked a little bit on something that was called Grand Lake Curriculum Integration. I was back east at a small women's college that for a term, and that's what the agenda was. So I spent time kind of studying that, working with other women on this issue, came back here, and I was invited to different places to talk about it, and I could feel it was always men. I was invited to men's groups, classes of men, faculty, and the hostility was so thick. It was so problematic. They didn't want to be there. This was like, you know, when human resources brings you in and forces you to listen about how to get along with everybody else. It wasn't working. So I think one of the things that I began to think about was, how is this going to end? And I thought, well, it's going to end, or it's going to get better when the old people die off. I'm sorry to say that. I'm one of them. But in some ways, I think that the university, my department, sociology, became much more flexible, much more open to women and to feminist scholarship after I retired, when they hired some more lefties like me, and they had one was a man, one was a woman. The woman went on to become chair of the department. And I understand now that sociology, I hope I'm not wrong about that, is over half women. Well, that's, you know, I was the only woman for years in the department. So, you know, that's really changed, and that certainly, you know, is to the good. I can't speak anything more about, you know, what else has happened in other departments and so on and so forth. So there's been a push that's positive, but then there's been this kind of continuing ghetto in intellectual kind of work that has to be necessary because there's not much space yet for it in the rest of the disciplines of university. I don't want to overstate this because I do believe that in anthropology and sociology, there are efforts made to change that. I know that men and women are writing together and men are trying to write things on these kinds of issues. So it's not, I don't want to, you know, engage in hyperbole. But I do always consider this an issue. It's always for me a worry. And I really worried when women's studies became a department at Portland State because I thought, what? You know, the idea is that there should be, women's studies should be everywhere, not just one place.
All right, I'm Julie Allen, and I'm going to give you the perspective of someone who was a graduate student at Portland State during the early 1970s and who was taking part in this effort to create a program. I want to give you three key words that I think articulate what we were doing. First of all, we were challenging what was considered to be the received notions about what was college material and what wasn't. Beyond that, we were collaborating. And we were collaborating across disciplines, as Nona has said. We were collaborating across communities. And we were collaborating across hierarchies in the sense that students and faculty were working together easily on these projects. And then finally, we were crafty. And by that I do not mean arts and crafts. I mean that we used the available resources in unorthodox ways to get what we wanted. Nona has spoken a little bit about the context, and I couldn't agree more that what took place took place because it was in a particular time and place. There were these huge struggles going on around the Vietnam War, around race and class injustices, and this was an international movement, in fact. We were reading things like Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed. We were reading The Schoolboys of Barbiana, who wrote Letter to a Teacher. These were books that were questioning the direction of education. And they were asking that education begin with the experiences of the students. Paulo Freire came up with the phrase, the banking style of education, which was what was taking place at the time, that students were simply empty vessels to be filled. So as students, we wanted the colleges to speak to us, and we wanted to begin with our own experiences. And we also wanted the colleges to participate in changing society, not continue to reproduce it as it was. So this atmosphere coincided with women being thoroughly fed up with post-war fear-mongering and conformity and the suppression of women in society. And by 1967, radical feminist energy had erupted again. and there were organizations being founded, such as the New York Radical Women, Red Stockings, the Women's Liberation Front. There were consciousness-raising groups all over the country, and there were mimeographed articles. And one of the things that I think is important about this particular moment is that this is when inexpensive printing began to be available. And so people were able to print off their ideas, and they did. There were multiple newsprint publications, there were magazines, there were things. Xeroxing was still a little expensive, but we were masters at the ditto machines. And so you got things like that were not necessarily being vetted in scholarly journals, such things like The Politics of Housework. And these were informally being studied in the community, and the community was coming up with things like a Woman's Place bookstore, the Women's Liberation School, the Feminist Women's Health Clinic, car repair, radio broadcasting, lighting and sound for performances. Women were teaching each other how to do things, and we wanted the same thing to start happening within the universities. So Portland State was ideal because it had a history of serving the community. It was established to serve the returning veterans from World War II. And that's not to say, though, that, as Nona has pointed out, there was plenty of resistance. But at the same time, there was still an atmosphere that we could move into and begin to build something. As students, few of us were coming straight from high school. Most of us had been out in the world working, and a lot of us had been or were still working as secretaries, because that was the kind of work that women were able to get at the time. So we brought a lot of knowledge and skills to this incipient women's studies program. The program in the early years offered courses, but the courses were not well funded. They were dependent on people like Nona offering things as overloads, or occasionally a department would let somebody offer something that was related to women, such as Nancy Porter's course on Doris Lessing. But there was no organization, so as students, we created one, and we did it by using the student fee-based resources. So we organized the Women's Union, and within the Women's Union, we were able to get an office for women's studies. So student fees funded women's studies. And then beyond that, we began to find other ways. There was a program called Chiron, and Chiron was also student fee-based. And within that program, a student who had particular expertise in an area was allowed to teach a course on that if she or he could get a faculty member as a sponsor. So that's how I was able to teach a course in feminist critical theory. So we had students teaching Chiron courses. We used student fees to pay a nominal amount to students who then taught Introduction to Women's Studies. And then we also paid ourselves to organize and go around and interview faculty members and try to persuade them to offer courses. And that's how we got some absolutely marvelous courses like Biochemistry of Women. And we also used various other sources. Summer school, we discovered, had very little oversight in the sense that anybody could offer a course if they were approved by the director of summer school. So that's how we were able to get a wonderful scholar named Jane Bowers, who taught women and music and went on to establish herself as a major scholar in that field. All right, so at the same time there was a proposal. We worked on the proposal. A woman named Margaret Bird came in and rewrote and typed up the proposal, which was no small matter in those days. And we shepherded it through all the committees and up to the state board. The program was funded and then defunded about four or five years later. And I just want to say my own personal hero from that moment, this was the early 80s, Laurel Kirsch, who has since passed away, was the secretary in the University Scholars Program. After the program was defunded, packed up in boxes, put into a warehouse, Laurel stayed after work. She had access to the vault where the records were kept. She stayed after work for weeks, compiled statistics demonstrating that women's studies was worth funding. And that was she was able to make an argument based on statistics. That's what allowed the program to regain its funding. And just in conclusion, I will say that we were often criticized for being reformist, working within a male institution, but at the same time, we did accomplish a lot, and the last thing I would say is that we wouldn't have gotten anywhere if we'd always played by the rules.
Hello, I'm Joanne Reynolds, and I'm the associate lawyer that was on the Penk case. I happen to have the distinction tonight of being the only panel member and probably the only person in the room who's wearing open-toed shoes. Yes. So, didn't think about it this morning, but here I am. The lawsuit, I was introduced to it on my very first day as a brand new associate at the office. I was whisked away to a press conference on my first day at the firm Wilner Bennett Bobbin and Hartman was the name of the firm. And it was a discrimination case against all of the eight institutions, against the Board of Higher Education and all the eight institutions in pay, promotion, and tenure. There had been a forerunner suit, which was called Wilma Hine against the Oregon College of Education. And that was eight women, and they sued the school, and Don Wilner was also their attorney. And they sued under the Equal Pay Act. Under the Equal Pay Act, you only talk about salary. If you have comparators that are similar in jobs, skills, and duties, and you don't make the same, you've made your case. You don't have to show there's an intent. You just show the disparity in pay. So they won that case. It did go up on appeal and came back and had some things, but eventually they won that case. So then we thought, well, if they have that at Oregon College of Education, how am I? Not close enough? All right. Is that better? Okay. So we decided let's take on the whole Board of Higher Ed, because with a larger group of women, statistics will show there are large disparities. And when statistics are used to show the large disparities, they won't be able to explain them away. Well, so there were eight institutions. It was University of Oregon, Oregon State, Portland State, the medical school, OHSU, and then the four smaller schools, OCE, which is now Western Oregon, Southern Oregon, OIT, Oregon Institute of Technology, and Eastern Oregon. So all eight schools. and the class action was that there was discrimination against women in pay, promotion, and tenure. This, of course, required us to show intent. The case took 9 months to try. We were in trial for 9 months, which coincidentally is just about the time it takes to make a baby. We thought that was prophetic. The court found there was no dispute that there was disparity. In other words, everybody agreed that there was a disparity, a statistically significant disparity. But what happens in a case is first the plaintiffs, that's the women, we put on our case and prove the disparity. Then the defense comes in and they say, but here there are other non-discriminatory reasons for that. And then we get to rebut theirs by showing their reasons are pretext. So we said there was a disparity, and the defense came in and said there were legitimate non-discriminatory reasons. I have to say our strongest case was pay. There's no question about that. In promotion and tenure, even looking at the cases, we were a class action, so all of the women in the entire state system were included in the class. And even as plaintiffs looking at it, you think there are individual determinations on those factors. Now, we still had statistically significant differences, so we felt good moving forward on that. But it was especially hard to show discrimination in promotion and tenure. And the state would come in with factors such as the quality of teaching. A lot of them were subjective factors. You see, quality of teaching, community service, service to the institution, research quality. Now, that was how do you measure that? Sometimes they would say, well, her articles aren't cited often enough, or her articles aren't cited in the right journals, or that, you know, and then scholarship. All these things are subjective, and they are legitimate factors. So basically, our approach was we use statistics, and we're going to show that there's such a broad discrepancy over the whole population that they can't come up with enough reasons for it. And their defense was, but in this case, there was a difference. In this case, there was a difference. In this case, there was a difference. So they did the individual, and we did the broad. We were talking against each other to some extent. I have a note up here. Oh, yeah. We just tried to be all-encompassing. And the more encompassing, the harder it was for the defense to rebut it. So one huge consequence of doing this was me sitting at the counsel table with my client next to me. Marjorie was not one of the plaintiffs. And listening to this person who's extremely respected in a collegial department and has a lot of respect from her peers. So she gets up to testify, and that's nerve-wracking enough. Then she comes and sits down next to me, and her department chair comes in, who's been her friend and colleague, and starts saying things like, well, she had a smaller caseload, or she had a larger caseload, but she didn't have the right publications, or she did not enough service, or too much service. There was always, we began to call it the yeah, but defense. Whatever we said, they said, yeah, but. So that's what it was. So, however there were, the court decided that the individual defenses were sufficient, that we were unable to prove by statistics only and by our anecdotal evidence. We had a lot of anecdotal evidence that that we were unable to prove intent. We had proved the disparity, but were unable to prove intent. So I was asking some of the witnesses who testified in preparation for this. I called a few people, and they said that they really felt that it had done some damage to their departments. They feel that they had recovered afterwards, largely because of time and because of new people coming in, but that it really had done some damage. And one of our witnesses had continued to do salary analyses because that was part of her job in the sociology department. And she said that she felt the cohort of women at that university were still being discriminated against. So basically, I just wanted to read you the court's final analysis. It said, this is the Court of Appeals. It said, while the plaintiffs find fault with the way the trial court interpreted the statistical evidence, and then the Court of Appeals said, with 2020 hindsight, we might view some of the statistical evidence differently. So they were throwing this little bone saying, well, maybe you were right, ladies, but we're not going to find that the court made error. So that was the end of it. And again, recited that the plaintiffs had proved that there were disparities in the salaries and other terms of employment, but did not prove they were the product of disparate treatment. So it was an amazing experience, and Marjorie's going to talk a little more about the effects on the personal.
I have a little prop here because it's Don's birthday. I have what went on his birthday cake. The reason this is important, it's a real cheesy, cheapo little plastic tennis player. He played tennis, but you can make it left-handed or right-handed, and he was a left-handed tennis player. And everything assaults the prejudice against the left, so we'll put that out there. He was really pleased that it could be made left-handed. I came into the case in midstream. Other people had been working at it for a while, and I became aware of the case, and I became one of those that went down and helped at the office and ended up being a witness. A witness meant I had to have two comparators from my department, and that was pretty easy. There were two other people who overlapped me, males, in 19th century British literature. They both had been put on the tenure track. I had not. They had both had sabbaticals. I had not. And they had sabbaticals without ever publishing anything. They had neither of them published anything. I'd already published. But I had one of those department chairs who was uncomfortable with women making advancement. It's the term I used for him was that it seemed unseemly for women to be wanting to get more money. Nice enough fellow, other than that. I'll give you a little touch about my own personality. I would go down from Portland State on Broadway to the courthouse. This will tell you something about my nature. I'd pass a place that said Nails on Broadway. Why not nuts and bolts and screws? Why just Nails on Broadway? It took me weeks to realize what Nails on Broadway meant. That's it. Tells you a lot about me. The rest of them laughed at me. At the very end of the case, the lawyer for the other side stood up as his closing statement said something to the effect, I'm not going to have this just right, but I'm going to give you the sense of it. If the women in the Oregon State system of higher education have received less pay and other amenities than the men, it's because they have deserved less. Well, the case ended right then. I don't remember which other woman, we just jumped on him and nailed him. He was rather embarrassed. I don't think he believed that we were inferior. I don't believe he believed that, but he'd made his case and trying to win the case as he did. I was asked as a witness, and I didn't answer it as well as I could have on the spot, why, if it wasn't true that I had published more because I was not always teaching full time. Of course, I had four children, and one of them was, a toddler, but that's when I realized that my two comparators had a whole year off with pay and hadn't produced a thing, but I didn't come up with that on the stand. It came to me afterwards, so I was feeling pretty unhappy about myself in that position. It's hard up there, though, isn't it? They say, isn't it true? Isn't it possible that because? And finally, well, yes. The case ended, and we're trying for appeal, but before all of that had started, I'd left for the Fulbright teaching in Norway. It's the second time I taught in Norway. And I got a phone call one day from Don, very upset that they had lost. He used to say to people, and he even said it to Helen Fry, the judge, I may have lost the case, but I won my wife. I wanted to share a letter I got from you from a woman named Ann Hofstetter, and I talked to her today, and I talked to Anna Pink. I have a flyer here. Well, it's from the web. A fascinating woman from Greece. She worked as a child running messages during the war, working as a child spy. Brilliant woman, absolutely brilliant. I'll read you a touch of what it says here in this one blurb. It said, described as brilliant by her professors, her doctoral dissertation in mathematical logic earned her worldwide acclaim, yet despite her excellent education, outstanding teaching reviews, and international reputation in mathematics, Professor Pink continually found herself being treated as a less valuable faculty member than her male counterparts. She received far less pay than the male colleagues, taught many more courses, repeatedly was denied tenure-track positions, forced to share an office with other females while men had their own offices. I was in the same office with another woman for years. And we are now back as emerita. Both of us are in the same office again, the same windowless office. We've come full circle. I feel like I'm supposed to die now because Deanne and I are back in that same office. But, you know, and others got their own office. Just to share a bit of Anne's poignant letter she said to me while I was in Norway. I won't read much of it. That can be boring. Okay. Dear Marjorie, you know the worst by now and are probably depressed since you do not have the advantage of a support system and the grand plan to win the war, although we lost the battle. I want to pause a minute. Here in this letter, in 1985, in February, Ann Hofstetter says, although we lost the war, we lost the battle, we're going to win the war. Today, she said to me on the phone, we lost the battle, but we won the war. And I was surprised what Joanne was saying, because in my department, things became better very quickly. Don lost the case, but to my mind, things became better for women, quite a bit better, immediately. And I was tenure track and moved right up from there. Any rate, Anne says she picked up Don at his office, and she and another woman went to the courthouse. And one woman went in and picked up the decision. Don sat in the car reading it. He was stunned. So were we, she writes. Obviously, we lost on the statistical witnesses of the state, 600,000 for Siskin.
He was the state's East Coast statistician, right?
That's what they spent for him alone. And we had Mary Gray, who was both a lawyer and a mathematics professor. Where? In
Professor Ramsey. Wasn't
and Ramsey, too, but Mary Gray would come and help us.
Mary Gray. Right.
Mary Gray, wonderful woman. But these people were having to almost volunteer at times. At any rate, 6,000 for Siskin. And then Anne goes on to say, I remember back to the day Don was so upset because the judge would not allow our expert to rebut. So we were even stopped from doing that. Don turned to me and said, we just lost the case. I didn't believe it possible at the time, but evidently he was right. So she talks about Don suffering, and they went to Anna Pink's house in Salem and waited for her. And finally, everybody gathered there. They dropped Don at Mount Angel, where he was just too depressed, and he went to be with the monks. He's Jewish, but he went to be with the monks. All right. She said they had a wake of sorts. They sat around having a wake. And then a woman, Margaret Lumpkin, who had been so powerful and capable, wonderful woman, had been in London, and she said, Anne says in her letter, Margaret had a sense she needed to come back, and came back on a plane and was there, and she immediately got everybody fired up again. What a shot of adrenaline she is, Anne writes. I immediately felt 100% better and called Don's friend. So this woman started us saying, we're going to go on appeal, we're going to fight again. And then what happened? Anne talks about women going to the legislature and talking to legislators who were very, very sympathetic. Repeatedly, she found ones that said the State Board of Higher Education had not done well by us. And she talks about Margie Heinrich saying in front of the legislature, if you're guilty, you always have the most expensive lawyer. I'm not sure that's true, but is at any rate. If the state is so pristine, why did they have to spend $4.5 million At any rate, Suzanne, it was very heartening. Now you have to measure this in mid-1980 prices, too, which makes a difference. Several bills were put into the hopper, she said, bills trying to solve the problem other ways since the suit hadn't done it. So people were still going on. They had looking for other attorneys for the appeal, but the problem was getting money. The women were giving the money, and it was tough going. Don was greatly in debt. He borrowed it all sorts of money. And that's the way it was for some while after that. He was in debt. Margaret was going on talking to the legislature, but Ann says, at any rate, it feels good to be fighting. Then she says, as you know, only three plaintiffs won. All of those were from that first case that the same judge had ruled in favor for. It makes the statement that perhaps she didn't want to change her mind on everything. So even mentions that newspapers came out saying that the state had done poorly. The Oregonian, she says, even the Oregonian thought that the man, what's his name, was Lum? Lemon, who was on the state board, he got up and made one of those snide comments, too. He crowed, says Ann, about how little money it would cost after the trial, as well as saying that women didn't know how to negotiate and that's why they'd lost. So Ann says it's been our problem all along. But the legislators tore into him for that, which was kind of nice. That's all I'm going to share with you from that. But it was extremely emotional time. I had to type up Ann's letter because she wrote it in longhand, and I couldn't have read any of it to you right today. Exactly. To me, it was one of the emotional times of my life, the most emotional. I wasn't there at the time the decision came. I was getting it from this very dear, very kindly letter from Ann Hofstetter and from Don's phone call. I couldn't believe that we would lose. It just seemed so obvious that we were right. And I looked at my comparators. I looked what happened to Anna Pink. How little credit she was given as a woman mathematician. And yet we did. Yet we lost. But in my case, and in Anna's too, good things came from it. It does say in Anna's letter that, the piece from the web, that she was given $485.17 in damages. But they did make her a full professor.
She got a promotion. I forgot to mention there were three, out of the 22 plaintiffs, there were three that had their cases that prevailed. And they were all from Oregon College of Education. They weren't from the other lawsuit, but they were from the same school.
From the same school,
yes.
And the same judge.
Right. The same judge heard both cases, right. Thank you.
So before we open it to the audience, I just wanted to see if any of you on the panel wanted to react to anything others had to say. Or
I had one question I had remembered from what Don said, is that they said that maybe women didn't have good publications, but they did not have statistics on publications.
Right. They didn't have statistics on publications.
So they
individual approach into them.
So to say that women didn't have good publications, possibly, you know, we suspect it's that. They didn't have proof of it.
Correct.
And it wasn't true.
Yeah. Nona, you were a plaintiff also?
I was
get on the mic.
Yes.
I wasn't a plaintiff. I was a witness.
A witness.
And I was a witness. I told Joanne this. I was on the stand. I had been on sabbatical the previous year, and I was on the stand, and they had all these statistical charts on one of their props, and they were trying to prove that I was something, you know, less than I was supposedly was, and the wind came up, and it blew them out the window and into the courtyard, and they went flying down to the courtyard, and nobody had a key to the courtyard. And I thought that sums up the suit. They really have no data.
Do we have comments, questions out here?
Oops. I'm just curious as to the men's mentality during that period and your male coworkers, and what do you think was the benefit of, I mean, were there any allies, or what was the benefit of them all being against you?
Are you talking about the case, or are you talking about women's studies?
What's that?
Are you asking
during,
about the law case?
And your colleagues during the male coalition?
Well, either of us could answer.
I think there were supportive male faculty as well, and Marjorie can speak to that more personally.
Very much so, although my department chair had said when there was somebody trying to get a divorce, oh, don't do that because you'll need your husband's money. Somebody was underpaid. So there were attitudes of that sort, but definitely. I mean, women didn't get the vote on their own, in a way. They had to have men convinced. I'm always aware of that, that there have been men who've supported.
The same in women's studies, that the first thing that we put on in the ballroom, I remember that Dave Kressler, who was in the psychology department, helped organize that. And that was in the January 1970. I think that's correct.
Could you say more about that event?
Well, I don't really remember an awful lot more about it, except that it must have been part of what the students were doing, going around trying to get women in all the departments to participate. But we also wanted to make sure that there was student support and that that people knew what we were doing. Do you remember that any more than I do? I just remember that I was about to go on sabbatical. I just had surgery, and I was, I was so grateful that I had a lectern to kind of lean on. I have no idea what I talked about, and I think there were numbers of other people in that ballroom, but it was an attempt to try to inform the whole university that we really had an ad hoc program going. I think it was before Meg. When was Meg hired?
She didn't come till around 66.
No.
76.
76.
I'm sorry.
So from 69 when we kind of began all this, and then the proposal, which I remember working on in the summer of 1970 when I came back, that we had 6 years in which we were kind of seat of our pants, and I always thought that Nancy Porter, who unfortunately couldn't be here tonight, was really the mainstay of keeping the program organized and going, and right? You might want to say something more about that.
Well, certainly Nancy was critical in keeping the program alive. But it was, as I said before, it was very much a collaborative effort. And everything requires money, and in our case, as I said, it was coming from student fees. At some point, Chris Thompson from the English department got involved, and she was also very, very supportive and very active. So,
when did the program move to social science? It moved from Bill Hamilton to George Hoffman.
It was sometime
later.
During the 80s.
Oh, okay, a lot later.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was actually a student. Go ahead.
I think it may have been after the program got defunded and then was refunded when I was talking about that it moved into social science.
And George was actually one of the people I complained about when I was on the witness stand because... and there was an article in the Oregonian because I had submitted a grant application to him, just a courtesy. The grant application wasn't to the university. It was to who knows what. And he wrote back a little note that said, yes, I approve the grant, but I think women's proper place is really in the kitchen, in the home, in the bed. And...
You at home
this was the dean of the College of Social Science, and I went.
Drop jaws.
Yeah, and I was married then, and my husband said, "Oh, he's just kidding." Male reaction. And the chair of the department, who was a friend of mine, Chuck Bolton, said, "Oh, he's just kidding. That's just his humor." And I said, "Yeah, some humor." And they say, "Women, what's that cover? You know, women have no sense. Feminists have no sense of humor."
Uh-huh.
Well, this is just part of the context discussion because you mentioned Margie Hendricks. And as all this was going on, Patsy Mink was coming in running for president. And Margie then ran against Hatfield. And, you know, so that this, what was going on in the universities as in the women's movement, it wasn't just the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, there was a women's movement. Yes. And there were so many different things that were happening in all these arenas of power that, and these women, I mean, I loved listening to you all, you know, who fought the good fight and who sort of laid the foundation for the change that started to come fairly slowly in these different places. But, yeah, I just wanted to add that to the context.
I'd like to add something, too, because I left it out. Because one of the things that I think I really wanted to make a point of was that I think what's happened, and those of you who are, like Julie, who are more closer to academia or maybe people in the room who are still teaching, my sense is that that some ways the disciplines, not just women's studies, have kind of drifted away from the issue of power. And that's where we began the women's studies, was with the whole issue of power. And that I don't want to overstate it, but I was just with a former graduate student of mine who teaches at a university in California, and she said she's having trouble trying to find a home for the work she's doing, which has to do with trafficking at a global level, that she goes to things and people seem to be involved with kind of textual analysis and Gaufman-esque interaction kind of analysis of things, and that the issue of social power, which is what we were trying to democratize, however much we floundered and failed, we were trying to do that, and it seems like it's marginalized. I mean, that's kind of a question for those of you in the audience. It seems like it's a marginalized issue, which pretty distressing to early founders.
It was definitely a period of, I would almost say, hyper-democracy, with some teachers letting their students get themselves their own grades. And I remember I was a student at the period when the women's studies was forming, and not women's studies, but the classes. And I can remember being in a meeting where we were choosing the coordinating committee, and everybody who was interested put their name in a hat. And that's how we chose them, by pulling them out, which, you know, isn't necessarily a bad way. I just don't know that that would happen today. But, you know.
I stopped letting students grade themselves because I thought, surprisingly, they would undergrade. And so I would.
They were?
And I was a hard grader. I would have to raise grades. I was like, what's going on?
Were they women? I guess we do have a low self-esteem.
Well, these were probably, I was probably doing this in women's studies classes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. There's one point that I didn't have time to make that I would like to mention, and that is that I talked about the notion of fluidity and the fact that we were able to do what we did because the university was flexible enough to allow us to do that. And there was also this fluidity between community and university. It was this, some of the same people who were working in the community were in the university. And as people went through women's studies classes, and as they gained knowledge and confidence and began to be able to analyze their situations and the situations of other women, they began to form institutions in the community. It was people from women's studies who established the Rape Relief Hotline, which is now the Portland Women's Crisis Line, who helped to establish Bradley Engel House for victims of domestic violence. And I could go on, but this is an instance, it seems to me, of this wonderful fluidity between the community and the university that women's studies fostered.
I have a question for Joanne. You said you spoke with people today, and some of them felt that the department had been damaged. I wasn't quite sure what you meant there. Their relationship with the department or the department itself had somehow suffered. It wasn't true of my situation at all, but I was curious.
I'm so glad to hear that. And you can tell we didn't talk to each other before we came.
Well, not about that. We did talk.
About that. Yes, yeah. We spoke. Yeah. This was, I think what she was talking about was the relationship between the women who were part of the case and the male colleagues and department heads in that particular department. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't general. You know, I only spoke with a few people, and this one was the one that was most memorable to me.
I see. Well, English department people are pretty liberal, and they certainly, Nancy and Chris Thompson, Nancy Porter and Chris Thompson would be very quick to see if I were teaching a course on George Eliot, who's a female novelist, if somebody doesn't know that she wrote under that name, and that would be double listed right away in women's studies and the English department. So, and the men are more liberal, I think, in English departments. Could you say what department it was? I'm wondering if it was a science or business or
sociology.
Sociology, you would
but
think,
not,
would
not
be
here.
A little
it wasn't
better.
Sociology
no, no,
here.
No,
and I know. Still, wouldn't you expect better?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I thought that a lot. There, is this going to be recorded?
Too late. It is, I think, already.
You know, there are a lot of people in any department, including sociology, who might be very liberal, but then have personal hang-ups, can I put it that way? Personal problems dealing with women, didn't think women really belonged in the department, and so on and so forth. And so you could always get grief from those guys. But given the structure of the university, it was hard for them to get any control over the fact that I wanted to teach sociology of women, for example. But I also was in a different place because I was a plaintiff, and so were you. I was a witness, not a plaintiff. Mm-hmm. And I think it meant that my department chair never came to the court to testify what a horrible person I was. He could continue loving me. I do think that makes that mm-hmm. maybe was one of the sources of the differences. Mm-hmm. Because, the people in sociology were all, you know, liberals, Democrats. There were a couple socialists among mm-hmm. them and so on and so forth. But they were guys, you know, who wanted to continue male privilege for the most part. Right?
I'm really glad to hear that it was not a universal experience and that for the most part people felt good. My friend also said that, you know, with time and with the increase in women coming in and younger people coming in, the gaps began to disappear. And she feels that for a lot of reasons over time there have been remedies, including efforts at the legislature and affirmative action issues.
Ann told me today, Ann Hofstetter, of the letter I shared. She said, I think maybe we had our suit too early. It wasn't the time for it yet. And I didn't agree with her because when is it too early? When mm-hmm. when do you step out? And in her letter, she said, we lost the war. And talking to me today, she had it in reverse and agrees that the world is better. And we did make a difference.
I don't think you should lose the symbolic value of the actual case. That mm-hmm. certainly my memory of the case, and I knew only it as it being out there, but it had enormous symbolic value. And people said no, they had to think about it. They had the issue was raised in their mind. They had to identify the problem and think about it and come to some conclusion about it. So it you know, I think a lot of these things operate that way, as the actual decision is not as important as the event itself and what the consequence of that event for the psyches, because we were talking about consciousness raising, and women started, wait, what is this? This is, I don't need to put up with this anymore, much like Nona's experience going to a meeting, hearing the testimony, hearing about the case for many young women was, I don't have to listen to this. I don't have to do this. It's not me. It's not my personal problem. It's a general problem.
That's a very good point.
Personal is political. Yeah. Had a lot of meaning.
And that's a really good point to hear you folks who were more broadly involved in it. For me, the case was the case, and that was my only exposure to it at all. So I love hearing the fact that there were things happening on different fronts, talking, you know, small groups moving along, legislature, things like that. And that's really the way progress happens.
How many Philadelphia lawyers were there compared to you and Dawn?
Oh, gosh. I think there were four or five that they hired a firm from Philadelphia, and then plus several AGs. They had two lawyers for each of the institutions. So there were plenty.
My husband always liked an uphill battle.
He did. He did.
So that's 20 lawyers?
It was something, yes.
On their side. It's really shocking to hear $4.5 million when you think of the raises they could have given with that $4.5 million.
Yes, right, right.
So I'm wondering if
I just have a question about the context. What year was this?
Oh, good question. It was filed in 80, and the trial. Then it takes a long time to do discovery and all those things. The trial actually took place from 84 to 80, over the 84, 85.
Okay.
It was probably September to June or something like that. And then the decision came out several months after that.
And you said your strategy was to use the Equal Pay Act. And well, why the Equal Pay Act versus
In the first case where the eight women won, they did the Equal Pay Act. And under the Equal Pay Act, you just show the disparity in pay. You don't have to show intent. And why did we choose the other one in the other case? We wanted to include promotion and tenure because we felt as we're going to do it, we may as well clean it all up. And those were harder to prove. They just were harder to prove. I really felt that we would win on pay and lose on promotion and tenure, but they all got swept in. So, but we had, three victories. And then afterwards, some of the really compelling cases, we brought claims for individual people or groups, and they either settled right away or we had smaller trials and they got resolved. So it wasn't all for naught.
What act was the second one brought under? It wasn't the Equal Pay Act?
It's a Title VII. Title VII. And under Title VII...
Title VII of the Civil Rights?
Title VII, discrimination against women. Title VII is Title VII, discrimination against everybody.
Yeah.
But women is one of them. That's uh-huh. right. Okay. Yes, civil rights. Yes.
Okay.
And in that one, you have to show intent. And you can show intent by statistics, but if the other side gets up and starts refuting them, then, there's a possibility that they will be able to do that, and they did.
So this is the same act that women got equality, supposedly, in athletics?
That's Title IX. But it's the same act.
Same act.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
This was the one that was accidentally passed. Yeah. Women were accidentally, I'm sorry, the act wasn't accidentally passed, but women were added to it accidentally.
Title VII.
In an attempt to kind of torpedo it. Otherwise, women wouldn't even have been in that
That's
act.
Right.
Yeah.
Could you say a little more about that?
Well, I can't remember which smart senator from the South who didn't want equality, racial equality, thought that he would make this ridiculous, and so he added an amendment at the very last minute, adding women in.
Am I right? That's my
yes. That's right.
Yeah, that's
big
my
joke
memory of it.
Of it.
And then, and but the result was that the whole thing got passed. But the you know the important thing was we wouldn't have been in it, except for his.
The important thing is we ended up in it. I don't care how we got there.
Exactly, but you know the ridiculousness of thinking
yes.
that
it was yes,
that
it
we
was.
Were so we were so. What?
Mm-hmm. So such an so absurd.
So absurd that women would want
to get thrown out. Right. If we're going to add blacks and everybody else, let's just go all the way and add women.
Yeah.
And a pass. Wonderful.
Well, I want to thank you all. Does anybody
thank
have
you.
Anything? We have a few more minutes. I'm sure.
Well, the only thing I'm more interested in if other people in the audience have anything to add. I thought there was going to be more audience participation.
We have a lot of people who are some of you students now?
The KBOO contingent.
As a social work student, I've had the privilege of being, of having professors, all women, and being in classes with all women. But when I've entered the job market, I face this, what I call the addictive organization power structure. And sometimes it's a woman sitting at that desk protecting or standing guard of that paradigm. And so what insight could you give a male black activist that my heroes are Dorothy Day and Jane Addams and Audre Lorde and Alex Walker. What would you tell me as far as continuing the collectivity of allowing that to come into my own career?
I pass. I mean, it's kind of like you're young, you're out there in the world, and you're going to work it out. And, you know, I'm an old person from a different age cohort, different historical time. You're going to develop your own advice from your own experiences. It's the only thing I can say.
I would say look for allies wherever you find them.
I'm not a panelist, but I'd just like to offer that you just keep doing what you're doing. You're voicing your consciousness about this issue, and that's very important. Someone said in curriculum we should have two things. We should have a window and a door. And every curriculum needs to have the window so we can see the world and see what they're doing, and we need to have that representation in the classroom. We also have to have a mirror, not a window, a mirror and a door. And the mirror is for us to be able to see our own experiences in the classroom as well. So for any kind of classroom you're in, if the professor's not providing a mirror and a window or a door, you need to question that. And I think you've certainly provided both of those things tonight, so thank you.
I wanted to say, since it's Don's birthday, he was a state senator for 10 years, in Oregon, also representative 2 years. He made Portland State a university, and that was an uphill fight because the University of Oregon and Oregon State weren't keen on the idea. He did a lot of things of that sort. He wrote the Scenic River Act. He did the first migrant pay in the nation, I've been told, pay for, and that was bipartisan. He was a Democrat, but in those days he said they worked better together. The first time they made rulings that that migrant people had a right to a certain pay, migrant workers.
Any other comments? Okay. Well, thank you all
thank you
very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
very much.
For coming. Please don't forget to take a look at the evaluation forms, the sign-up list, the petition, the KBOO information. And thank you, everyone who's been listening over the air, and those of you who came out early. Happy to have you here. Thanks for coming.
Don't stop fighting.
And that was the voice of Sandy Polishook. She's been the host and moderator of this evening's panel discussion from Portland State University, where KABU Radio is broadcasting live. I'm Ani, and I have been one of the folks down here with the crew. I want to give thanks and a shout-out to the rest of the crew tonight. We have Kate Welch, we have Becky Ney, we have Desiree Garcia, Jenka Soderberg, and, of course, Devin LaCroix. Thanks, and Jill Severson, also on the field recording and audio setup tonight. So thanks to all of the KABU crew, and thanks to all of the panelists for presenting this look at Portland women's history. This evening's panel focused on Fighting for Ideas and Dollars, the formation of the Women's Studies Department at Portland State University, as well as the landmark law case of Pank et al., which was a Title IX case looking at equity for women's work. This concludes tonight's live broadcast from Portland State University. We are now sending the signal back to our studio on 20 Southeast 8th, back to KABU, where we will be joining Brandon for Drinking from Puddles just about now.
You've been listening to a live broadcast from Portland State University of a panel discussion called Fighting for Ideas and Dollars on the History of the Portland Women's Movement.
Pride Northwest Incorporated is proud to announce its 2013 official Pride schedule of events for June 9th through 16th. We have a full week of exciting happenings designed to showcase and celebrate the LGBTQ community, including a Star Trek theme party, a special film screening, a comedy showcase, and a Tony Award-winning musical. The week will conclude with the 43rd annual Portland Pride Waterfront Festival and Parade, June 15th and 16th at Tom McCall Park. More information about the Portland Pride Festival and Parade can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hey, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM here in Portland, Oregon, 100.7 FM Corvallis, Albany, Oregon, Columbia Gorge, you're listening at 91.9 FM, and hello to you worldwide at www.kboo.fm. No matter where you're listening, welcome. Time now for another edition of Drinking from Puddles. Getting a late start tonight because of the preceding special live broadcast and panel discussion. But we'll be here till 10 o'clock playing music for you. Let me tell you that tonight's Drinking from Puddles is being made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from STG Presents, bringing London-based indie band The XX to the Schnitzer Hall on Monday, May 27th. Tickets for this all-ages show are available at the PCPA box office or online at Tickets West. Tonight's Drinking from Puddles program is also being made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Seattle Theater Group, presenting an evening with Primus 3D in a psychedelic multimedia experience Saturday, May 25th at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. Tickets and information for Primus 3D at pcpa.com. Okay, yeah, I got new music, old music. I got till 10, so let's get on with it. I'm going to start things off here with a little Trod Gross Akstenar from Arjun Shravandraj, and this one is entitled Ring Ring. Trod Gross Akstenar. It's here for you on listener-supported KBOO Portland and the program Drinking from Puddles. I'm Brandon. Thanks for tuning in.